in the hope that it would bring them closer. On these occasions, Stan would always find an excuse for not going. They used to have a ritual whereby Elena would tell her friends and co-workers that she and Stan were going away for the weekend. She would get excited, make plans, and start to pack. A few days later, she would call them sounding defeated and worn out to say that something came up at the last minute, and they never went. Once it was his work, another time he wasn't feeling well, and yet another time the car needed repairs. They'd have a huge fight, and then things would calm down again, until the next time. For Elena, getting her hopes up only to be disappointed again and again was a painful experience. Eventually, Elena's relationship with Stan ended. She never really grasped that her fights with him were about something much more fundamental than whether to go on vacation, or even about romance for that matter. Instead, they were about a big barrier that he put up between them. And even if at some deep level she did understand, she wasn't able to truly accept this reality or live with it. Other people do find a way to live in relative peace with colliding intimacy needs. How do they manage? They come to terms with the fact that when it comes to certain aspects of the relationship, things are not ever going to change. They understand that they can choose to live a Sisyphean life of ongoing disappointment and frustration, one in which they will continuously fight a losing battle. Or they can change their expectations. They learn to accept certain limitations and adopt a number of pragmatic life strategies. They admit to themselves that in certain areas their mate is never going to be an active partner, and they stop urging him or her to change. They stop taking personal offense when their mate pushes them away and accept that this is simply his or her nature. They learn to do things on their own that they previously expected to do with their partner. They engage with like-minded friends in activities that their mate is unwilling to participate in. They learn to be thankful for what their mate does do and to overlook what he or she does not do. We know countless people who, after having struggled with ongoing intimacy conflicts, finally make a shift in their mindset and find a compromise that they are able to live with. Doug, 53, used to get furious at his wife on a daily basis when she came home hours later than expected. He finally decided to stop getting mad when she walked in and to greet her warmly instead. He made a conscious decision to make home into a place she would want to come home to instead of a battlefield. Natalie, 38, always dreamed of sharing her leisure time with her husband. After years of resentment and bitter fights over his refusal to spend weekends together, she decided to change. Today, she makes plans for herself. If he wants to join in, as this rarely happens, he's welcome aboard. But if not, it's so long and see you later. Janice, 43, is married to Larry. Larry, who was married before, doesn't take an active role in raising their joint children. Janice has come to accept that when it comes to the kids and several other areas of their life together, she is quite literally on her own. She no longer expects him to participate and no longer gets angry when he refuses to do so. All these individuals share chronic, ongoing intimacy collisions with their partners. They have chosen to let go of the dream of being truly intimate with their partners and have found a way to live with the limited togetherness. They compromise. But make no mistake, the compromise is in no way mutual. It is, in fact, wholly one-sided. Instead of engaging in endless conflict that results in nothing but frustration and disappointment, they have decided to change their expectations and reduce conflict to tolerable proportions. Deciding to let go of the dream. Do we recommend taking this route? Our answer is, it depends. If you're in an ongoing relationship riddled with intimacy clashes that you have not been able to resolve, and yet you want to remain in the bond for whatever reason, then yes, this is the only way to live in relative peace. Your satisfaction level in the relationship will be lower than that of people who don't experience such battles, but it will also be higher than that of people who choose to relive these fights day in and day out without ever accepting that they are about fundamental differences that aren't going to go away. If, however, you're in a relatively new or uncommitted relationship and are already experiencing a lot of intimacy collisions, we advise you to think long and hard about whether you want to make so many concessions in order to be with this person. There is a major difference between couples who are dealing with non-attachment-related issues and those who are engaged in intimacy struggles. While the first couples want to find a common ground and reach a resolution that will bring them closer together, the latter either engage in ongoing, irreconcilable fights, or one of the two is forced to compromise unilaterally in areas that are near and dear to him or her. But there's more. This attachment collision can go from bad to worse. The next chapter depicts how intimacy clashes can get out of hand, what it takes to recognize the situation, and most important, how to leave it behind. Chapter 10. When Abnormal Becomes the Norm. An Attachment Guide to Breaking Up. Clay and Tom were enjoying a romantic dinner on their anniversary. Clay was gazing lovingly at Tom when out of nowhere, Tom snapped, "What the hell are you staring at? Stop staring! It's really annoying!" Clay wanted to get up and leave, but restrained himself. He said nothing, and they finished their dinner in silence. Throughout their hiking trip in Guatemala, instead of walking side by side and sharing the adventure, Gary would walk ahead of Sue, occasionally making snide comments about how lazy and incompetent she was for walking so slowly. After Pat finished giving her husband the no-reciprocation sexual treat he asked for, he said, "That was awesome, and the greatest thing about it was that it could have been just anyone, a complete stranger. That's hot." Pat felt as though she'd been punched in the stomach. In the previous chapter, we discussed problems arising from the anxious-avoidant clash and possible ways to resolve these issues. In some cases, however, even repeated efforts to improve the situation fail, and the interaction between these two attachment styles can become truly harmful. Unfortunately, in these cases, anxious and avoidant people can bring out the worst in each other. Abnormal becomes the norm. A common view is that only masochistic, pathetic people would tolerate such bad treatment, and if they are willing to put up with it instead of leaving, well, maybe they deserve it. Others believe that these people are reliving troubled childhood experiences in their adult life. The story of Marcia and Craig contradicts these typical assumptions. We met 31-year-old Marcia in the process of conducting interviews for this audiobook. She was very open and forthcoming in recounting her story to us, and had no qualms about revealing very intimate and often hurtful moments in her life. She told us she wanted her story to be told in order to help other women who might find themselves in similar situations. She wanted them to know it was possible to get out of a destructive relationship and find happiness elsewhere. Marcia came from a loving, caring family, and after her relationship with Craig, she went on to meet an adoring man who treated her very well. The only fault we could find with Marcia was that she was anxious and Craig was avoidant. As we've discussed in Chapter 5, there seems to be a gravitational pull between anxious and avoidant individuals, and once they become attached, it's very hard for them to let go. Marcia's story demonstrates what transpires in an extreme anxious-avoidant match and the mental struggle involved in ending it. Though disturbing, Marcia's story ends on a hopeful note. We've included it for three reasons. To illustrate the power of the attachment process, to show that even emotionally healthy individuals can become entangled in a destructive situation, and to let people in those relationships know that they can find a better life for themselves if they muster the strength to leave. Marcia's story. I met Craig when I was in college. He was cute and sporty, and I admired the way he looked. Plus, he was a tutor in physics, my major, doing work that seemed far more advanced than mine, so I thought he was brilliant. From the beginning, however, there were things about his behavior that confused and upset me. When he first asked me out, I showed up for what I assumed was a date, only to discover it was a group event with a bunch of his friends. Although I knew that any woman would have understood his invitation the same way, I gave him the benefit of the doubt, allowing for the possibility that I'd misread him. Soon after that, he asked to go out with me alone, so I chalked up the first date to a misunderstanding. A month later, I thought I'd surprise Craig by showing up to cheer him on at his track practice. Not only did he not thank me for my support, he ignored me completely. He was with his friends and didn't even say hello. What could I do but conclude that he was ashamed of me? Afterward, I confronted Craig about his behavior. He said, "Marcia, when we're in the company of other people, I don't think they need to know we're a couple." His words made me furious and reduced me to tears. But then he hugged and kissed me, and I made up with him. Soon, despite Craig not acknowledging our relationship in public, it became apparent that we were indeed a couple. Unfortunately, it wasn't the last time I discovered that we weren't on the same page. We'd been dating for several months, and to my mind, our relationship was progressing nicely. So, to make things clearer, I told my old boyfriend, whom I'd still met on occasion, that I couldn't see him anymore. When I mentioned this to Craig, his response caught me off guard. "Why did you tell your ex that? It's still very early, and this might not lead to anything." After a couple more months of seeing each other, Craig and I finally seemed to be in sync. He was moving into a one-bedroom apartment, and I suggested I move in with him. I liked it that he was making a commitment and agreed. It seemed perfectly natural to everyone. Craig was a great guy, and he made a good impression. People who knew him superficially thought he was really nice. The truth, however, was that my life with Craig was becoming an emotional roller coaster, and I'd find myself in tears on a daily basis. For one thing, Craig was always comparing me with his ex-girlfriend, Ginger. According to Craig, she was perfect. Smart, beautiful, interesting, and sophisticated. The fact that they still kept in touch was extremely difficult for me, and made me feel unsure of myself. While he was quick to build up Ginger, he was just as quick to belittle me, especially when it came to my intellectual abilities. It killed me that he thought that I was in some way slow. But I knew I was bright. After all, I was a student at an Ivy League university, so I let it go. My confidence in my appearance was another story. I felt insecure about my looks, and it didn't help when Craig would zoom in on some feature, a bit of cellulite, for example, and go on about it for weeks. The first time he saw me naked in the shower, he commented that I looked like a midget with huge boobs. I took his disparaging remarks to heart, and at times would even put myself down. Once, after I'd eaten too much and was feeling fat, I asked him why he'd ever want to have sex with someone so disgusting. Now, most boyfriends, indeed most people, would respond to such a horrible moment of self-deprecation with something encouraging, like, "Marcia, how could you say such a thing? You're gorgeous." But Craig simply replied, "You're what there is right now." It didn't even occur to him that his words might be offensive. As far as he was concerned, he was just making an observation. I did try talking to him about how hurtful he could be, a few times going so far as to say that he seemed emotionally handicapped in some way. But my words would go in one ear and out the other. There were occasions I'd swear to myself that I couldn't take his behavior anymore, and I'd work up the nerve to say I was breaking up with him. But I was never able to follow through. He'd tell me that he loved me, and I'd let him convince me that we should be together. Did he love me? Maybe. He'd tell me so almost every day. I'd justify his behavior, convincing myself that he wasn't to blame, that he was brought up without an example of a healthy relationship. His father was very domineering and treated his mother badly. I became adept at rationalizing that he just didn't know any better. If his behavior was learned, I could hope, think, possibly even expect that he could unlearn it and change. My denial required me to put up with a lot. Like his father, Craig was very forceful. It was all about him. We always did what he wanted. His opinions mattered more, in everything. He selected the movies we would see and planned what I would cook. Even though he knew that decor is very important to me, he decided we had to have a poster of Shaquille O'Neal in the living room. The living room! Because I was so deeply ashamed of the way Craig treated me, of the way I let him treat me, I never met my friends in his presence. Time with his friends was bad enough. I can be quite shy, and once, when we were out with some people he knew, I was trying to break into the conversation with an opinion. He interrupted the speaker. "Hey, listen up, my genius girlfriend wants to say something." Another time, at the beach, I asked him for a towel, and he shouted, "Dry yourself in the sun, in front of everyone." These were just two instances. There were many, many others. I kept asking him not to speak to me that way, but eventually I gave up. The one aspect of our relationship that made things bearable and allowed me to stay with him for so long was that, despite his words, Craig was very affectionate. We hugged a lot and would fall asleep cuddling. The affection allowed me to pretend I was satisfied with our sex life. Craig was the least sexual boyfriend I ever had, and the comfort of the cuddling would reduce the pain of feeling rejected. In my mind, I tried to compensate, but as time went on, my thinking became more and more distorted. I'd say to myself, "No one has a perfect relationship. You have to compromise on something. If that's the case, I might as well be with Craig." Since we'd been together for several years, I reasoned that I should stop wasting time and get married. Even after the terribly inappropriate comments he made when I suggested the idea to him, including, "But that means I'll never sleep with a woman in her 20s again," I still wanted to marry him. Marriage was the one decision that I pressured Craig into. As soon as he agreed, I knew it was a mistake. That was evident from the word "go." The ring he bought me was unimpressive and the stones kept falling out. What more of an omen did I need? Our honeymoon in Paris was awful. We were together all the time, and I felt literally shackled to Craig. We had plenty of time to enjoy ourselves, but Craig turned everything into a problem. He complained about the service at the hotel and went ballistic when I accidentally got us on the wrong metro line. That was a white light moment for me. When Craig started swearing at me, I realized that I was powerless to change him. When we finally got home and my family asked me about the honeymoon, I didn't have the courage to tell them it was a disaster. I said, "It was nice," in a pathetically feeble tone. What a miserable way to describe one's honeymoon. Though I felt trapped, I still couldn't extract myself from the nightmare. Time after time, when I mustered the courage to leave, Craig would convince me to stay. I began to fantasize that he would fall in love with someone else and leave, because I was afraid I'd never have the strength to leave him first. Luckily, Craig found the strength. When I told him I wanted a divorce for the umpteenth time, he again begged me to stay, but this time he promised that if I ever asked again, he wouldn't talk me out of it. I'm grateful that he kept his word. The next time things got unbearable, I told him I wanted out, and he said, "Okay." We'd signed a contract to buy an apartment together and lost $10,000 for pulling out of the deal, but looking back, it was the best money I ever spent. The divorce was relatively quick and easy. We stayed in touch afterward. Once I wasn't tied to him any longer, it was actually fun spending time with him, in small doses. He was interesting, affectionate, and charming. When he became hurtful, I would just get up and leave. Fortunately, Marcia went on to meet someone with whom she has a happy life. While with her new partner, she was able to change her job to one more rewarding and to develop a new hobby. She's never again experienced the emotional turmoil that she felt with Craig. Opposing forces. Marcia and Craig's story exemplifies how bad an anxious avoidant trap can become. Craig didn't feel comfortable with too much intimacy, so he missed no opportunity to put up emotional barriers between himself and Marcia, creating uncertainty at the beginning of their relationship, keeping their status unclear, having to be pushed into marriage, belittling her, avoiding sex, and using numerous other deactivating strategies. Clearly, he possesses an avoidant attachment style. Marcia has an anxious attachment style. She longed to be close to Craig. She was the driving force behind their marriage, and she was preoccupied with the relationship. Initially, she cried every day because of his behavior, a form of preoccupation. And later, she constantly thought of divorce, another way of focusing on the relationship. In a typically anxious manner, she fluctuated from highs to lows, depending on the signals from Craig, and resorted to protest behavior, threatening to leave but never actually following through. Her attachment system remained chronically activated, at least during the first few years, before she became indifferent to him. It is evident that each side had very different needs in the relationship, resulting in a continuous clash. Craig's need was to keep his distance, and Marcia's was to get closer. Craig's inflated self-esteem, an avoidant characteristic, fed off Marcia's increasing self-doubt, an anxious characteristic. But there were also endearing moments between them that made it difficult for her to leave. For example, Craig sometimes knew how to be very affectionate and loving, and how to soothe Marcia when things got to be too much, even though they usually got to be too much because of him. Yet every instance of their closeness was followed by his distancing, which is typical of anxious-avoidant relationships. A word about sex. Note Marcia's statement that Craig was the least sexual person I ever dated. Avoidants often use sex to distance themselves from their partner. It doesn't necessarily mean they will cheat on their partner, although studies have shown that they are more likely to do so than other attachment types. Philip Shaver, in a study with then-University of California Davis graduate student Dory Schachtner, found that of the three styles, avoidance would more readily make a pass at someone else's partner or respond to such a proposition. But even when avoidants do stay faithful, they have other ways of using sex to push their partners away. While people with an anxious attachment style prefer strong emotional involvement during sex and enjoy the intimate aspects of lovemaking, like kissing and caressing, avoidants have very different preferences. They might choose to focus only on the sexual act itself, foregoing holding and cuddling, or put rules into place like no kissing in order to make sex feel less intimate. Others might have sex only rarely, or never with their partner, or fantasize about others while doing so. Long-term couples may use fantasy to spice up their sex life, but they do so as a way to get closer. With avoidance, fantasy is not part of a mutual adventure, but rather a deactivating strategy to keep them isolated. In fact, in a study of married and cohabitating couples, Canadian scientists Audrey Brassard and Yvan Lussier, along with Philip Shaver, found that avoidant men and women had sex less with their partners than did people with other attachment styles. Intriguingly, they also found that avoidant men and women were more likely to engage in less sex if their partner had an anxious attachment style. Researchers believe that in relationships like Marcia and Craig's, there is less lovemaking because the anxious partner wants a great deal of physical closeness, and this in turn causes the avoidant partner to withdraw further. What better way to avoid intimacy than by reducing sex to a bare minimum? What's more, it's been found that the anxious partner uses sex to achieve a sense of affirmation and as a barometer of attractiveness in the eyes of his or her mate. We can see that a clash is almost inevitable when the anxious person ascribes so much importance to the sexual experience and the avoidant person wants to avoid physical intimacy. Of course, there are anxious-avoidant relationships in which sex is not an issue. In that case, the emotional detachment will take on a different form. Life in the inner circle. But sex was hardly the main concern for Marcia during the time she was with Craig. It constituted just a fraction of the deactivating strategies used by Craig day in, day out, whether with friends or in the privacy of their own home. His deactivation was relentless and never-ending. In short, Craig treated Marcia as if she were the enemy, in sharp contrast to the loving and caring persona he exhibited to the rest of the world. Craig was a great guy and made a good impression, People who knew him superficially thought he was really nice. That dichotomy confused Marcia. Of all the people in the world, she was the one closest to him, and yet he treated her the worst. How could he be so nice toward everyone else and so mean to her? It didn't make sense, and she thought that if she could make him see that he was hurting her, then he could treat her as well as he treated everyone else. Marcia wasn't aware that Craig treated her so badly, not in spite of her being closest, but because she was closest. She was now living within Craig's inner circle. When our partners join our inner circle, we become close to them in a way that we can be only with our closest relatives, our spouse and kids, and as children with our parents and siblings. Unfortunately, life in the inner circle for an anxious, avoidant couple is not a bed of roses. Once Marcia crossed that line with Craig, she got too close for comfort and became the enemy. The more Marcia tried to get close, the more he tried to push her away. This is often what life can be like in the inner circle if you have an anxious attachment style and you are with someone avoidant. Signs that you have become the enemy. You are ashamed to let friends and family know how your partner really treats you. You are surprised when people tell you how sweet, nice, or considerate your mate is. You listen in on your partner's conversations to learn what is really going on in his or her life. Your partner often consults other people rather than you about important issues. In an emergency, you feel uncertain that your partner will drop everything in order to be there for you. It is more important for your partner to make a good impression on strangers than on you. You're surprised when you see friends being treated considerately by their partners. You are the person most likely to be insulted or put down by your mate. Your emotional and physical health are low on your partner's priority list. Do these statements apply to your situation? Chances are that if you're getting the cold shoulder, if your partner is much nicer to strangers and usually pleads the fifth, choosing not to talk to you, you've become the enemy. Your only crime has been to become too close to someone who can't tolerate it. This is in very sharp contrast to life in the inner circle with someone secure. The inner circle when you're treated like royalty. Your well-being comes second to none. You are confided in first. Your opinion matters most. You feel admired and protected. Your need for closeness is rewarded with even more closeness. Many people in anxious, avoidant relationships think that the royal inner circle doesn't really exist, and that all people have the same inner circle experience. They assume that other people are simply not being honest about what goes on behind closed doors. But we're here to tell you that it does exist, and it's not even a rare occurrence. After all, secure people make up over 50% of the population, and their inner circle is treated like royalty. Smoking guns in Marcia and Craig's story. Within the first weeks and months of Marcia and Craig's relationship, various signs, as obvious as smoking guns at a crime scene, could have alerted Marcia to the trap she was getting into. Craig ignored Marcia when she came to cheer him on during track practice. He tried to hide the fact that they were a couple. He was surprised that Marcia stopped seeing her ex-boyfriend, suggesting that he didn't value commitment himself. He made devaluing and degrading remarks about her. He compared her unfavorably to his phantom ex, Ginger. He responded to Marcia's worries and self-doubts in a way that made her feel worse. Most important, in all of these actions, he conveyed a strong message that he was not able to properly take care of Marcia's emotional needs. For more about smoking guns, listen to Chapter 5. Admitting there's a problem. Many people who live in an avoidant, anxious trap have a hard time admitting to themselves and others that they are in a bad predicament. They'll admit that they're not completely satisfied with their relationship, then will qualify it by saying, "But who is? All couples fight. All couples get upset. How are we different from them?" they talk themselves into believing that their partner's behavior is not so bad. Others, like Marcia, are aware of their dire situation, but can't take the necessary steps to bail out. They might make an attempt, but get overwhelmed by the pain associated with leaving. Then they experience the rebound effect. The rebound effect. Once you're convinced that you've become the enemy, why is it still so hard to walk away? First, because it's very painful. As painful as it is to be mistreated by your partner, severing an attachment bond is even more excruciating. You may understand rationally that you should leave, but your emotional brain may not yet be ready to make that move. The emotional circuits that make up our attachment system evolved to discourage us from being alone. One way to nudge us back to the safety of our lover's arms is to create the sensation of unmistakable pain when we find ourselves alone. Studies have found that the same areas in the brain that light up in imaging scans when we break a leg are activated when we split up with our mate. As part of a reaction to a breakup, our brain experiences the departure of an attachment figure in a similar way to that in which it registers physical pain. But it's not just a feeling of pain that takes over. Other thought processes are also hijacked in the process. Once your attachment system becomes activated, another interesting phenomenon is triggered. You will get overwhelmed by positive memories of the few good times you had together and forget the multitude of bad experiences. You'll recall how sweet he or she was to you the other day when you were distressed and conveniently forget that he or she was the one who hurt you in the first place. An activated attachment system is immensely powerful. It is a very important reason why Marcia stayed as long as she did. Returning to the scene of the crime. What happens when you do reunite with your partner after a breakup? Myron Hoffer, a colleague of Amir's from Columbia University and a leading researcher in the field of the psychobiology of mother-infant attachment, describes a fascinating discovery in one of his studies. When rat pups are separated from their mothers, a number of physiological reactions occur. Their activity level goes down, their heart rate goes down, and so does their growth hormone level. In Hofer's studies, he gradually replaced each maternal attribute with an artificial substitute. He first warmed the pups with a heating pad, then fed them so their stomachs would be full, and later patted them with a brush, imitating their mother's licking action. He found that each intervention helped with one aspect of their separation distress. Feeding the pups helped maintain their heart rate at a normal level, warming them helped keep their activity intact, and brushing them helped raise their growth hormone secretion. But only one intervention alleviated all the symptoms at once, and that was the reunion with their mother. For humans, the situation is very similar. When we break up with someone, our attachment system goes into overdrive, and just like the rat pups, we can think of nothing but getting back together with our loved one. The fact that one person can take away all our discomfort in a split second makes it very hard to resist the temptation to see him or her again. Just being in the same room is enough to entirely relieve the anxiety in a way that no other single friend or family member can. For this simple reason, many individuals find it hard to follow through on their wish to break up, even after they've tried more than once to do it. It also explains why Marcia chose to maintain some contact with Craig long after they separated. Anxious people may take a very long time to get over a bad attachment, and they don't get to decide how long it will take. Only when every single cell in the body is completely convinced that there is no chance that their partner will change or that they will ever reunite, will they be able to deactivate and let go. Escape from Alcatraz. Even without knowing about the rebound effect, Marcia could see that she was in trouble. After all, she had experienced the rebound effect before. Marcia was afraid that she might have a change of heart again, and she was greatly relieved when Craig took matters into his own hands, standing by his word to leave the next time she threatened him with divorce. The night she said she wanted out, Everything happened very quickly. She packed a small bag and called her sister to pick her up right away. From an attachment perspective, this was a very well-planned departure. Being near her sister in a familiar, nurturing environment helped with one aspect of her distressed attachment system. Talking to her friends on the phone and getting their support was another. Eating ice cream and chocolate, yet another. None of these comforts completely relieved her separation distress, and sometimes she lost sight of why she had needed to break up with Craig. Then her friends and family would remind her, sometimes on an hourly basis, why it was necessary. When deactivating strategies are a good thing. Long before she actually made a break, Marcia had been unconsciously preparing her escape by beginning to deactivate her attachment system. After trying for years to make things work with Craig, by explaining her point of view, falling apart emotionally, and excusing his behavior, she finally gave up hope. In our interview, Marcia told us that whereas during the first few years she would find herself in tears on a daily basis, during the last year, she almost never cried. Emotionally, she was already starting to detach. She no longer believed that anything would change, or, in fact, that Craig could change. She started to notice more and more of his faults, and stopped concentrating on the occasional positive experience they shared. The process she went through was the same one that avoidant people engage in all the time. In order to avoid becoming too close, they focus on their partner's negative qualities and behaviors to keep their partner at bay. Marcia, although anxious, started to use deactivating strategies after having been burned emotionally by Craig countless times. Deactivating is a necessary process that must occur in order to get someone out of your attachment system. Starting this process while still with your partner, however, doesn't guarantee that you won't experience the rebound effect. Once your attachment system is reactivated as a result of separation, all bets are off. In Marcia's case, having started the deactivation process did help her get safely through the initial breakup phase and the eventual divorce. Today, Marcia is no longer in contact with Craig, and they are not friends. Instead, she went on to find herself a real soulmate. Surviving a breakup. The following 9 strategies using attachment principles will help you get through the painful experience of ending a relationship. 1. Ask yourself what life is like for you in the inner circle. If you can't decide to break up, ask yourself whether you are treated like royalty or the enemy. If you're the enemy, it's time to go. 2. Build a support network ahead of time. Start to open up to friends and family about what your relationship is really like. This will rekindle friendships you might have neglected due to shame or plain misery, and will also prepare them to help you when you make your move. See how in Strategy 7. 3. Find a comforting, supportive place to stay for the first few nights. You'll need all the support you can get at first. The temptation to rebound is very strong. Parents, siblings, or your closest friends can help you control that urge. 4. Get your attachment needs met in other ways. Recruit support from the people closest to you and seek diversions like a massage, plenty of exercise, and comforting, healthy food. The more you are able to quiet down your attachment system, the less painful the separation will be. 5. Don't be ashamed if you slip up and go back to the scene of the crime. Obviously, you're better off not re-establishing contact with your ex, but if you end up doing so, don't beat yourself up. It is very important that you be compassionate with yourself. The worse you feel about yourself, the more you'll want to go back to the false safety of the bad relationship you were in. Your attachment system gets activated more when you feel bad about yourself, and an activated attachment system means wanting to renew contact even more. 6. If you're having a hard time, don't feel guilty. Remember, the pain is real. Friends might urge you to forget about your ex, stop feeling sorry for yourself, and move on quickly. but we know that the pain you're feeling is real, so don't deny it. Instead, be kind to yourself and find ways to pamper your body and soul. You would if you had a broken leg. 7. When you get flooded with positive memories, ask a close friend for a reality check. Remind yourself that your attachment system is distorting your perspective on the relationship. Ask a friend to remind you how things really were. Even if you sometimes miss or idealize your ex, reality will slowly sink in. 8. Deactivate. Write down all the reasons you wanted to leave. Your objective is to deactivate your attachment system. The best way to do so is to recall the bad moments in the relationship, and the best way to keep them fresh is to write them down. Take a peek at the list when those invasive, positive memories creep into mind. 9. Know that no matter how much pain you're going through now, it will pass. Most people recover very well from a broken heart and eventually move on to greener pastures. Part 4. The Secure Way. Sharpening Your Relationship Skills. Chapter 11. Effective Communication. Getting the Message Across. Using Effective Communication to Choose the Right Partner. After a few dates with Ethan, Lauren found herself very confused. On their first date, they had gone to a romantic beach bar and spent several hours getting to know each other. At the end of the evening, he said a quick goodbye and disappeared. To her surprise, he called again to ask her out, this time to a performance at a waterfront club. They both had a couple of drinks and spent hours dancing together. They even took a stroll along the beach, but again, nothing happened. Just an abrupt, "We'll talk," when they parted. This pattern repeated itself one more time on their next date. Lauren, who has an anxious attachment style, thought that perhaps Ethan simply wasn't attracted to her. But then, why was he still asking her out? Maybe he just wanted the companionship? She didn't want to stop seeing him without a bona fide reason because she really liked him. A close friend encouraged her to stop speculating about the reasons for his behavior and simply ask. Normally, Lauren wouldn't have had the courage. She would have been far too afraid of the hurtful response she might get. But she reached a point where she was no longer willing to waste precious time on the wrong person. So, she did raise the subject with Ethan. Tentatively at first, but she found herself speaking very directly as the conversation progressed. "I'm looking for more than something platonic. What is it that you have in mind?" Contrary to her assumption, she learned that he didn't find her unattractive. He said he really liked her and expressed his desire for finding a partner. But when she went a step further and asked specifically about his no-touch policy, he didn't have an answer and kept beating around the bush. Although she didn't come out of the conversation with a specific answer as to why he wasn't interested in physical contact, she did get a clear picture about their future together. There was none. Lauren gave up thinking of him as a potential partner, but they remained friends. After Ethan confided in her about several other women he was dating who were obviously also becoming frustrated by his puzzling behavior, she finally put two and two together. The mystery around Ethan's conduct was not so mysterious after all. It became clear that he was having serious doubts about his sexual orientation. Lauren thanked God she'd had the guts to express her concerns early on, saving herself months of false hopes and certain rejection. Lauren's story is an excellent example of the importance of effective communication. Expressing your needs and expectations to your partner in a direct, non-accusatory manner is an incredibly powerful tool. Though it's used naturally by people with a secure attachment style, it is often counterintuitive for people whose attachment style is anxious or avoidant. One straightforward conversation with Ethan put an end to all the guesswork and theories Lauren had built up in her mind. For Ethan, it would have been convenient if Lauren had been willing to simply put up with his behavior indefinitely. He was getting what he wanted, a girlfriend to show off to friends and family to get them off his back, and time to sort out his sexual orientation. But by expressing her needs, Lauren was able to look out for herself and avoid getting strung along by someone else's agenda. In this case, attachment style was not the underlying issue, but Lauren had no way of knowing this in advance. If Ethan's behavior was simply a manifestation of his attachment style, effective communication would have uncovered that as well, and they would have both benefited from discovering early on that their attachment styles were incompatible. But what would have happened if Lauren had confronted him in this forthright way, causing him great embarrassment, only to discover that his behavior was the result of neither his attachment style nor his sexual orientation, but of simple shyness? Well, we know someone who had just such an experience. Tina's situation was very similar to Lauren's. On her third date with Sergey, Tina was sitting on the sofa next to him watching a movie and wondering why he wasn't making a move. She'd also had her share of dead-end relationships and wasn't willing to waste too much time wondering what Sergey's particular issue might be. So, affecting a coquettish smile, she simply said, "Can I have a kiss?" Though Sergey was taken aback for a second and mumbled something under his breath, he collected himself and leaned over to kiss her. That was the last time his shyness was an issue in their relationship, which is still going strong 3 years later. In this case, flirtatiously asking for a kiss was an eloquent use of effective communication. Tina expressed her needs, and although there was an awkward moment, her directness gave her relationship with Sergey a tremendous push that brought them much closer, not only physically, but also emotionally. Even if Sergey had reacted in some other way, and things had worked out differently, it would still have been helpful. People's response to effective communication is always very telling. It either allows you to avoid getting involved in a dead-end relationship, as in Lauren and Ethan's case, or it helps bring the relationship to a deeper level, as in Sergey and Tina's case. Effective communication works on the understanding that we all have very specific needs in relationships, many of which are determined by your attachment style. They aren't good or bad. They simply are what they are. If you're anxious, you have a strong need for closeness and have to be reassured at all times that your partner loves and respects you. If you're avoidant, you need to be able to maintain some distance, either emotional or physical, from your partner and preserve a large degree of separateness. In order to be happy in a relationship, we need to find a way to communicate our attachment needs clearly without resorting to attacks or defensiveness. Why use effective communication? Effective communication works to achieve two goals. To choose the right partner. Effective communication is the quickest, most direct way to determine whether your prospective partner will be able to meet your needs. Your date's response to effective communication can reveal more in 5 minutes than you could learn in months of dating without this kind of discourse. If the other person shows a sincere wish to understand your needs and put your well-being first, your future together has promise. If he or she brushes your concerns aside as insignificant or makes you feel inadequate, foolish, or self-indulgent, you can conclude that this person doesn't sincerely have your best interests in mind, and you are probably incompatible. To make sure your needs are met in the relationship, whether it is a brand new one or one of long standing. By spelling out your needs, you are making it a lot easier for your partner to meet them. He or she doesn't need to guess whether something is bothering you or what that something is. The beauty of effective communication is that it allows you to turn a supposed weakness into an asset. If you need to be reassured a lot that your partner loves you and is attracted to you, at least in the initial phase of a relationship, instead of trying to conceal this wish because it is not socially acceptable to sound so needy, you state it as a given. When presented this way, you don't come off as either weak or needy, but self-confident and assertive. Of course, effective communication means that you communicate in a way that is inoffensive and does not put your partner on the spot, but allows them to be open with you without feeling attacked, criticized, or blamed. Another advantage of effective communication is that it provides a role model for your partner. You set the tone for the relationship as one in which you can both be honest and in which each has the sacred responsibility to look out for the other's well-being. Once your partner sees that you can be so open, he or she will follow suit. As you heard in Chapter 8, it's never too late to start using effective communication to improve your relationship. It's one of the most powerful tools secure people use in their everyday life, with their partner and kids, and at work. It can really transform the way you handle yourself with the people around you. Judging the response. With effective communication, you might not be able to solve a problem or resolve your differences in one shot, but you can judge immediately how important your well-being is to your partner. Does she or he try to get to the bottom of your concerns? Does she or he respond to the issue at hand, or does she or he try to dodge you? Does she or he take your concerns seriously, or does she or he try to belittle you or make you feel foolish for raising them? Does she or he try to find ways to make you feel better, or is she or he only busy acting defensive? Is she or he replying to your concerns only factually, as in a court of law, or is she or he also in tune with your emotional well-being? If your partner is responsive and genuinely concerned about your happiness and security, you have a green light to go ahead with the relationship. If, however, your partner tries to evade important topics, acts defensively, or makes you feel foolish or needy, you should heed it as a serious warning sign. Why is it hard for people with an insecure style to adopt effective communication? Effective communication almost seems like a no-brainer. After all people can do it once they set their mind to it, right? Well, yes, as long as they are secure. Often, insecure people cannot get in touch with what is really bothering them. They get overwhelmed by emotions and lash out. Studies show that people with a secure attachment style don't react so strongly, don't get overwhelmed as easily, and can thus calmly and effectively communicate their own feelings and tend to the needs of their partners. Secure people also believe that they are worthy of love and affection and expect their partners to be responsive and caring. With these beliefs, it's easy to see why they don't let negative thoughts take over, how they can stay calm and collected and assume the other person will react positively. In fact, this attitude can be infectious. Nancy Collins of University of California, Santa Barbara, whose main research interests include the social and cognitive processes that shape close relationships in adulthood and the impact that these processes have on health and well-being, together with Stephen Reed of the University of Southern California, who studies the neural network models of social reasoning and behavior, found that people with a secure attachment style seem to function as effective communication coaches. They report being good at getting others to open up and talk about personal things. But what happens if you are not secure? If you're anxious. When you start to feel something is bothering you in your relationship, you tend to quickly get flooded with negative emotions and think in extremes. Unlike your secure counterpart, you don't expect your partner to respond positively, but anticipate the opposite. You perceive the relationship as something fragile and unstable that can collapse at any moment. These thoughts and assumptions make it hard for you to express your needs effectively. When you finally talk to your partner, you often do it in a way that is explosive, accusatory, critical, or threatening. Rather than giving you the reassurance you're seeking, your partner may withdraw. In fact, Collins and Reed confirmed this in their study. Men who dated anxious partners reported self-disclosing less often and rated their general level of communication as lower than others. The result is that after expressing your needs in a way that pushes your partner away, instead of using effective communication, you then resort to protest behavior, expressing your need for closeness and reassurance by acting out. By doing so, you miss out on all the benefits of this powerful tool. Unlike effective communication, protest behavior never gives you the opportunity to unequivocally address your concerns. Your partner may respond negatively, but you're never sure if he or she is responding to your need or to your protest behavior. Say, for example, that you call your partner's cell phone incessantly because you fear he's cheating. He decides that he's had enough and breaks up with you. You're left second-guessing, wondering if you actually pushed him away by acting so clingy, or if he decided that you really just weren't right for him. You don't get an answer to your original concern, which is whether he cares enough to listen to your worries, reassure you, and do whatever it takes to make you feel safe and loved. Therefore, despite your understandable fear of getting hurt, we advise you to avoid protest behavior by taking a leap of faith and adopting effective communication. We can honestly say that everyone we've known who has used effective communication has been grateful for it in the long run. Often, effective communication brings about huge relief by showing you just how strongly your partner feels about you and by strengthening the bond between you two. And even though in some instances the response may not be what you hoped for, and you'll be convinced that you've ruined everything, if only you had said or done something else, he would surely have come around. We've never heard anyone say in retrospect that they regretted raising an important issue in a dating or relationship setting. In fact, they overwhelmingly express gratitude that effective communication got them that one step closer to their long-term goal of either finding the right person or strengthening their existing bond. Take Hillary, for example. She was planning a romantic walk with Steve across the Brooklyn Bridge on a sunny Saturday morning, but when she called him, he told her that he'd started doing his laundry and would call her later. Seeing that Hillary was upset, her friend convinced her to call him back and urge him to finish his laundry after the walk. It was such a beautiful spring day, after all. Reluctantly, Hillary made the call. Not only did Steve restate his decision to finish up the laundry, he decided he didn't want to get together at all that day. Hillary was devastated. She was furious with her friend for talking her into calling him. She felt that by showing too much interest, she'd ruined her chances with Steve. Months later, a mutual friend told her that Steve was deeply depressed following his bitter divorce and was far from being interested or able to start a new relationship. Hillary realized that pushing the issue that morning had saved her from the grief that Steve's emotional unavailability would have undoubtedly caused her. At the time, Hillary was very upset with her friend and blamed her for ruining her chances with Steve. But she later realized that her friend had taught her one of the most valuable lessons in relationships, how to effectively communicate her needs. This was the first time that Hillary felt certain that she fully and genuinely showed up in a relationship, no games played. Though things didn't work out with Steve, she knew that she did her best to make it happen. She also began to discover that, more often than not, the reasons why people behave unkindly toward her have nothing to do with her attractiveness or desirability. Here's another example of how just stating what you want without any apologies can be powerfully effective. For years, Jenna, afraid of sounding desperate, wasn't upfront with the guys she dated about her great desire to get married and have children. When she turned 40 and her biological clock took precedence over everything else, she decided to tell potential partners on date number one that she not only wanted to be a mother, but was only interested in dating men who also wanted to have kids as soon as possible. Though she suspected, and rightly so, that most guys who heard this would run in the other direction, fear of rejection was no longer Jenna's main concern. She did drive a few prospects away, but ended up meeting Nate, who, far from being threatened, wanted the same thing. He found it refreshing that she knew what she wanted and wasn't afraid to say it. Using effective communication worked out well for her. Today, she and Nate are the happy parents of two. Like Jenna and Hillary, you too can learn how to use effective communication, even though it can be a scary prospect if you have an anxious attachment style. If you are avoidant, although there is nothing that brings two people closer than understanding and being understood by each other, effective communication has something to offer the avoidant person as well. As someone with an avoidant attachment style, you are often unaware of your need for distance and separateness. You feel the need to get away, but don't understand why.